From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are a lot of compelling parts in the story of Olive Oatman, young pioneer girl abducted by the Indians who massacred her family. She makes it back into white society, and all of that is fascinating. But one of the most interesting parts is her tattoo. She was given a chin tattoo by the Mojave Indians who raised her as their own. It meant she was part of the tribe, and it's believed she embraced that new identity. But as the journalist Margot Mifflin examines in her book, Olive also knew the tattoo would have a different value in the white world. But she owned it, her story, her tattoo. Mifflin says that tattoo was an emblem of where Olive would end up, standing astride two cultures. We're talking about Olive Oatman today with Margot Mifflin, and we invite you to join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are lots of captivity narratives, hundreds of them, in fact. But Olive Oatman's story stands out for some reason. Olive was a young pioneer Mormon girl headed west in the 1850s. Her family was massacred by the Yavapai Indians. She spent a year as a slave and then was traded to the Mojaves, who tattooed her and raised her as their own. She did make it back into white culture, and when she did, her story became a sensation. The journalist Margot Mifflin says her story was replayed in countless books and articles, and Mifflin says there are various reasons for that. Oatman had a mysterious persona, gothic beauty, but the greater part of the fascination, Mifflin says, is her unresolved duality. She describes her as a half-finished woman who never fully renounced her Indian family and yet struggled to settle back into white culture. Today in the program, we're talking about Olive Oatman's story today with Margot Mifflin. The book is called The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman. You can join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Margot Mifflin is an English professor at the City University of New York, where she also co-directs the Arts and Culture Program at the Graduate School of Journalism there. She frequently writes about women, the arts, and tattoos, which is the subject of her first book called Bodies of Subversion. And Mifflin is joining us today from a studio near her home in Nyack, New York. Professor Mifflin, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin with the question of, when did you first hear of Olive Oatman? What was your first reaction when you heard that amazing story?
I had written my book, Bodies of Subversion, which is a feminist history of tattoo art, starting in the late 19th century with circus women who were getting tattoos, you know, sometimes full-body tattoos and presenting themselves for public display. The book was published, and the history in this country sort of started there. And I was lecturing at universities on it and discovered through a grad student the story of Olive Oatman, which had not been well documented and had been extensively misdocumented. So I started to explore in order to include her in a second edition, and then realized her story was big enough that she warranted a book of her own.
What I really want to spend some time with the significance of her tattoo. But did the story transform? I mean, it's not just about that tattoo, although that's a critical part of it. Did it become something more than just this expression of body art? And did you become more interested in the particular story itself? I mean, how did it evolve, I guess?
Yes. Well, it fanned out in so many directions. It's a sort of a feminist history adventure story in the sense that she was a woman who, once she was captured and lived with the Mojave, who incidentally treated her well. She had been previously captured by the Yavapai, who did not. they traded her to the Mojave, and the Mojave adopted her. And so she lived a really free life with the Mojave. Women in the tribe had a lot of freedom to be physical, to swim and ride bareback, and to voice their opinions within the tribe. So in her case, as in a number of captivity stories that preceded hers, the appeal was that these female captives were able to do, and in her case especially, able to do things that women of that period weren't able to do. So it's an adventure story, sort of following, a long history of captivity tales going back to the founding of our country. It's also a story about the settling of the West. At the time she was traveling, the geography of the Southwest was shifting literally under her feet. When she set out on their journey, and her family's journey in 1850, California became a state. And where they were, where the attack happened, was in Mexico before this little last piece of Mexico was absorbed into the U.S. So there's a lot of culture clashing going on in that area among people pushing west, you know, under manifest destiny, and clashing not only with Indians who were sort of, in the way in their pursuit of claiming these new lands, but also with Mexicans who had sort of gained status as Americans after the Mexican-American War.
This is interesting because it seems like the context, as you put it, is that Olive kind of stood at the crossroads of history. This was when the West was, as you put it, stolen. Americans mm-hmm. traversing millions of square miles of this newly acquired land. And as you say, they were kind of blind to the geographical borders, of course, but also the cultural borders and the psychological borders.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And, the Mojaves in particular were one of the most interesting parts of researching this story because they had not really experienced many whites before she came along. And so they were very free and open to explorers. The few explorers who had come through their territory before them had documented, including Jedediah Smith and Garces, the Spanish missionary, mm-hmm. who came through and tried to convert them almost a century before Oatman was with them. They were just an amazing tribe. And I think one of the interesting things about researching it was understanding who they were and how much has been lost. They were sort of a case study in what happened as a result of Manifest Destiny. Mm. And they were, 4,000 strong then. There are only 1,000 of them left now. But they were just a very fierce and beautiful tribe. And one thing that their story illustrates is the variety of cultures within Native American culture and even within California Indian culture.
Yeah. I actually want to spend some time a little bit later in the program with that culture because the sort of sexual exploration, the sense of freedom that Olive really took to is a really interesting part of the story. But let's sort of get to that mm-hmm. that part. So we need to back up a little bit. And I mentioned Olive Oatman, that she and her family were Mormons, but they were a very particular brand or sect of Mormonism, mm-hmm. now extinct. They were called the Brewsterites.
Right.
Mention that. This is really interesting. The prophet of this sect was an 11-year-old boy.
Yeah, he started as an 11-year-old who had a vision about this sort of Zion that he imagined for Mormons in the West. But he was 19 when he set out on this journey with his parents and with followers. And this was soon after Joseph Smith's death, so there was some confusion about who was going to lead the church. He led this splinter sect on the southern route to California, a few years after Brigham Young had set out on his journey. And so this was a very interesting sect. It was progressive in a lot of ways. They did not believe in polygamy. They imagined this community that they would set up that was very communitarian, pacifist. They said that they would not have guns or any kind of military operations in their community. It was very well mapped out, like literally square mile by square mile of where churches and schools would be, for example.
No, so, no capital punishment, for example, also. That was interesting.
Right, yeah. So if they had succeeded in establishing this community, which they tragically did not for many reasons. I mean, the effort to do this was tragic for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It would have been one of the first utopian communities in the West.
Royce and Marianne Oatman, these were Olive's parents. What were they looking for when they decided to go west with this group? What were they trying for? I guess they had the same impulse that a lot of Westerners had when they came west, I guess.
Yeah, and Royce himself was a bit reckless. He was an adventurer. He was a Mormon who also considered himself a preacher. He preached. He rode around the countryside in Illinois before they went on this journey, preaching and claiming to have cured people of various illnesses. But he himself suffered some weather-related joint, I think, illnesses that made him want to go to a warmer climate. The problem was that there wasn't a lot of documentation of the trails west and the life west. So what they imagined from what they had researched was that they were going to this fertile wooded area where they could set up shop and farm. And they imagined it as being very lush and wet, which, of course, was exactly the opposite of what southern Arizona and southern California were and are.
Yeah.
So they were in for a surprise. It's unclear what Royce was really trying to do, and he had these seven children and set out on this dangerous journey. And as they traveled, they discovered just – initially it was fun. Mm. It's documented that they camped out at night and they sang songs around the campfire and they had sermons on Sundays. And the children had a lot of fun playing games and consorting with each other. I think it was hard work, especially for the women. The men had to hunt for food along the way. They had given very specific instructions, the organizers, about what to bring, what kind of cookware and sleeping arrangements, and down to the details of they were asked to pack boxes that were of consistent sizes so they could lay them down and put mattresses on top or beddings on top of them at night. So it was very well organized, but what they didn't realize was how difficult the roads could be, how long the trip was, that many of them were likely to be attacked by Indians and were, other travelers. And it started to get very dark as they proceeded. They saw people's belongings thrown by the side of the road, of the path. They saw starved cattle, that had been abandoned. And then ultimately entire wagons that were just unhitched and left because their cattle was so depleted they couldn't pull them anymore. And that happened to the Oatmans. They started out with a few wagons and ended up with just one.
What was the – it's interesting, Royce Oatman's reaction. He was so panicked. And, of course, there was reason to be afraid of hostile Indians. You write mm-hmm. a bit about the sort of conventional Mormon view of Indians, and we should maybe remind people of that. You mentioned how in the Book of Mormon they paint a kind of menacing picture of Indians. And I'm wondering what impact that had on people's fears, particularly Mormons going west.
Yeah, I don't think Royce Oatman shared that fear because he had encountered Indians in Illinois and he had a fairly positive view of Indians. He believed if they were treated right, they would be kind. Yeah. And I guess what he didn't consider is that wasn't a situation where they were seeing intruders into their land, repeatedly as Indians in the Southwest were. So they were starting at that point with the westward migration to get worn down by people coming through their land. And that's where it started to go wrong.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the disposition of these very different native tribes in the region. Some were thought to be friendly. Others, like the Apache Indians, for example, had become angry about white settlers encroaching on their territories. And they had a reason to be angry because you point out in one case, I think Mexican officials had placed bounties on Apache scalps. So there was a lot of anxiety on both sides here, I guess, a lot of attacks and raids and reason to be angry, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. The exception for the Mojave was that they hadn't really seen many whites. They had been protected. So you know, literally there was Garces, the missionary who had come up in the 1700s and tried to convert them and shown them pictures of people burning in hell. And the Mojaves just looked at these murals that they were presented with and said, none for us, thanks, and refused to be converted. And then trappers came through and were not any great threat to them. They traded with them. They were very open to outsiders and wanted to trade. But at the time that Oatman joined them, they were sort of in the twilight of their sovereignty. They lived a beautiful life on the river. They swam every day. They played sports. They rode horses. They played this hoop game that sort of had no boundaries. They just ran around rolling this hoop and competing with each other for hours. They were very garrulous. They loved to talk. The few people who documented their first encounters with them said that. So on some level, they were naive about the people coming into their land because they hadn't had trouble before, and they liked the idea of trading. But soon after Oatman left them, they realized the dangers that were around them. There's also some theory or some possibility that one of the reasons they took the Oatmans was because they were starting to see what could happen. They may have taken them as as someone they could trade back to the Americans if they did have trouble, as sort of diplomatic pieces they could trade. They had seen what had happened to the Kishans near them, where they had allowed missionaries to come and work their way into their culture, and it had been disastrous for them. Their land had been stolen. So I think that the Mojaves may have thought, along with wanting to save these girls from the first tribe that captured them and use them as slaves, mm-hmm. they may have thought this could be a good diplomatic device for us if the whites do indeed do it to us what they've done to tribes around us.
Yeah. So Royce Oatman, he splits with – there's a lot of tension, I suppose. At the first, the journey is kind of uneventful, but it didn't take long before they start to bicker. They argue about religion. And Brewster, who was, as you said, young and he was believed to be – he thought he was this prophet and – he kind of acts crazy. I mean, he finds a stone that had some Indian pictographs on it. He said he was translating it. He changes his plan about where they're headed.
Right. There's a funny story about how they're all planning to set out on this journey, but his family has forgotten their cats, and they have to spend 2 weeks waiting for his dad to go back and retrieve the cats. So that was apparently typical.
Yeah, it was so strange. They had talked about splitting, but they stayed together for a time for the protection of the Indians. But they did eventually split, and we don't have time to tell the entire story of Royce Oatman, but he ends up just with the one wagon with his family, and this is when they're attacked. Would you just give us a sense of what happens in this part of the story?
Yeah, so they're traveling. They've gone down the Santa Fe Trail, and their group is starting to deteriorate. People are peeling away. Some people are dying of illness, and other people are arguing about the things you mentioned. Some are arguing about which trail they should take and whether they should turn back or take a different route. And so finally, the Oatmans find themselves with just a few families. If you imagine, they're south of Phoenix in Maricopa. And they're deciding that they're going to go out on their own. Now, one significant factor here is that they have 7 children and Mrs. Oatman is pregnant, right, and very pregnant, 9 months pregnant. So Royce decides that they're going to push on alone. The other families with them say, we're not going. We've heard reports from people who've traveled out and back again saying there are Indians who are dangerous. And so probably because because of his wife's pregnancy, but possibly because of his recklessness, he pushed out into the desert. So if you imagine they're, south of Phoenix, they're trying to get 150 miles to Yuma, and they're only about a third of the way into that journey when they're attacked near Gila Bend. And so they're really struggling to get there. They've forded the Gila River. Again, this is Mexico at mm-hmm. this point. And they're making a big struggle to cross the river, and they get up on a plateau that they have to mount. Their cattle's not strong enough to get over it, so they have to take everything off their wagon and hand carry it up the hill. That's when they spot 17 Yavapai strolling up the hill who decide to attack. They approach them with the premise of just chatting and finding out where they're going. But before long, they attack and kill the whole family, except for Olive and her little sister, Marianne, who was 9. Olive was 14. Right. And they are taken by the Yavapai, presumably because it seems to be a pattern that girls were more assimilable into Indian tribes, especially of that age. They were old enough to be helpful in work, but they were young enough to be absorbed into the tribe and assimilated and not run home or try to escape. So what they didn't know was that their brother, their older brother Lorenzo, who had been left for dead, recovered and crawled back to civilization and spent the next 4 years trying to find his sisters. He didn't know where they were. And ultimately did. That's how they were split up in the attack.
I think it's interesting, the Yavapai, why it was they took the girls. I mean, you mentioned, I guess in some ways they just wanted the labor, but it's so interesting, they weren't known for raiding, the Yavapai. It just seems like they were desperate.
Yeah, it is a mystery. They did seem to be desperate, and they did seem to need the labor. They, unlike the Mojave, they lived in the mountains, and they lived a hard scrabble life. So likely they just wanted to take slaves who would help them work.
I think the Yavapai culture was interesting, too. I mean, you don't write a lot about it, but, I mean, they had very modern-seeming beauty practices. I thought this was really interesting. They were kind of brutal to the girls at first, quite brutal actually to the girls at first, but they kind of softened eventually, settled mm-hmm. into a – and they were with the Yavapai for, I guess, a year, I suppose it was.
That's right. It was a year. And it does seem like it changed during their time with them, because initially they were beaten and they were mocked. And there was, when they were taken to the tribe, there was a whole initiation ritual where people spat on them and poked them with sticks. But then by the end, Olive is telling about conversations she has with them about religion, where she tells them about her God, and mm-hmm. they think it's very funny that she imagines a God who's up in the sky, and they you know, poke her about the fact that it's a very precarious God who could fall down at any minute. And so that would indicate some kind of freedom and independence, that she could speak that freely about religion with them. Yeah. So I think they did soften up. And then it is, she does say that by the time she was taken, some of the Yavapai were sorry to see them go.
The Mojave, they first have an encounter, and they see these white girls with the Yavapai. And at first they bargained for them, but they weren't able to make an arrangement. But eventually they were a chief, a leader of the Mojave, and this was in the spring of 1852, sends his 17-year-old daughter to basically cut the deal. Tell that story. That's really interesting.
It's a neat element of the story in that she's the daughter of this man. There's not a lot of detail about it except that she did cut the deal. It's just interesting that she was deployed to do it. And touching in the sense that she became Olive Oatman's Mojave sister. She took her back. Olive and her sister were adopted in her family. There were a couple of brothers who don't really figure much into the story, except that when 4 years later, when the U.S. Army took Oatman back, one of the brothers was very angry and asked her to return beads that he had given her. So it's unclear whether that was a romantic attachment or a filial attachment or what. But they did get absorbed into this family and actively adopted. And one of the interesting pieces of doing the research was discovering how much has been mistold historically. Yeah. The fact that, it seems very clear that they did adopt them. They gave them the tattoos because they considered them members of the tribe. The Mojave did take slaves, but they didn't tattoo them. They only tattooed their own. So the girls got these chin tattoos and arm tattoos that were traditional. They were often given during adolescence, but not always. Some people reached the end of their lives and asked for them because the tattoos were intended to ensure that they arrived in the afterlife, number one, as opposed to going down a rat hole, which was the alternative. And number two, so that their ancestors could recognize them when they got there. So that's kind of a beautiful idea that the Mojaves imagined that these white girls would be recognized as Mojaves because of their tattoos in the afterlife. And then there are a whole number of other things that indicate they willingly adopted them and loved them. One was that when Marianne, who died a year before Olive was ransomed back, she died during a famine, Aspinejo, their mother, cried all night and then kicked into high gear to try to make sure that Olive didn't die in this famine. And mind you, this woman had her own children to feed during this drought and a famine that they were struggling through. They also gave her a clan name that indicated she was a clan member, and they gave her a nickname, which I probably can't say on the air.
It's pretty graphic.
The
whole idea behind it, and we'll actually talk a little bit about this kind of sexuality of the Mojave culture, which is kind of interesting, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So the name, it was a nickname that indicated they were the Mojaves were very bawdy and loved to joke and loved to tease each other. So they gave her a teasing name that was very sexual in nature that implied that she had had a lot of sex, and so that was one factor. It seemed like they treated her well. Also, when her sister died, their burial practices were cremation, and she didn't want her sister cremated. She wanted her sister buried, and she pleaded to one of the headmen to do that and was granted permission, and they helped her bury her sister. So her treatment by them, they also gave her a little plot of land to farm, you know, in the area where they lived. So it does seem clear that she was loved by them.
Margo Mifflin is with us. Her book is The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman. And we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the fascinating story of Olive Oatman. Margo Mifflin is with us. She's written a book about that story. It's called The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman. She's joining us from a studio near her home in Nyack, New York. She's an English professor at the City University of New York. So the tattoos that she and Marianne, her sister, received, it's interesting. You say that Olive knew that the tattoos would have a very different value in the white world, that she'd be branded a savage. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because she knew that this would diminish her chances of living normally again. But you also say she submitted to these tattoos, or at least we think she submitted to these tattoos willingly, that she realized this was a part of, you know, becoming a part of the Mojave culture. So I guess this is a good way of talking about that duality, that maybe that sense of internal conflict she felt about all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the Mojave elders I interviewed when I was researching the book, who's now deceased, talked about how no one was ever forced to be tattooed. It was always voluntary. So it appears that she and her sister submitted to it. Also, the tattoos are pretty clean, so it doesn't appear. I mean, they healed cleanly, and the lines are fairly clean, so it doesn't appear that she struggled while she was getting the tattoos. And it does appear that she, whatever follow up treatment they required, mostly in terms of eating soft food for a few days after the tattoos, that she did that too. So I think at the time she got the tattoos, she didn't believe she would ever return to white society. She didn't believe she had any family left in white society. And also she was, you know, being assimilated into the Mojave society. So so there was that. But they did take on an interesting symbolism in a number of ways. First of all, she's the first documented white tattooed woman in the U.S.
Right.
And later circus performers copied her story, said they had been captured by Indians and tattooed unwillingly. And so that was a piece of it. And then also, so yes, she knew that when she went back, she would be considered a freak, which she was. And, you know, people pointed at her and stared at her, and it was fairly humiliating. But the symbolism of it is what's interesting in that, you know, in light of everything I said about the shifting cultural contours of the country and the area where she was, she became a very public bicultural American. She really did, you know, was a part of two cultures, and that was designated by this tattoo. I don't think anyone has so publicly displayed their biculturalism as someone who's wearing this tattoo on her, you know, a white woman wearing a Mojave tattoo on her face.
Yeah. What did white American culture at the time make of tattoos? You said she was seen as a bit of a freak. So these were sort of freak show things.
Yeah, except they weren't really even in the public consciousness. This was before circus performers,
right.
You know, decades before circus performers were doing this. So there were at the time people doing, you know, tattooing sailors and tattooists in port cities, tattooing men primarily.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something commonly seen. So it was pretty freaky and people didn't know what to make of it, and people thought it was fairly revolting and that, you know, it destroyed her face. So I think when she returned, she imagined, probably rightly, that it was going to be very difficult to return to society with this on her face. But people were in, you know, people who knew her were able to adjust to it. It didn't seem to retain its freakishness for a long time. She went back after her ransom. And incidentally, when she was ransomed, she evidently did not want to be, because the negotiations between the U.S. Army and the Mojaves lasted an entire night. And they insisted that they didn't want to give her back, but were told, if you don't, we're going to bring in the Army. So they did. They knew that they had to make that choice. So she went to Oregon. She reunited with cousins in Oregon and reunited with her brother, who was the one that had initiated the search that ultimately found her. And they seemed to get, you know, used to her there. This was in Medford, Oregon. It was then called Gasburg. So she then was, that was where she met the reverend who wrote her story that became a bestseller, but twisted the story, notably by removing the Mormon element from it. He was a Methodist, and he just sort of conveniently cut out every Mormon reference from her story, which was my first flag that this account was not correct, because the whole story happened because she was a Mormon.
Well, and the racism, which we'll come back to, too. It's interesting because she was – it seems like the sense of conflict, and you get this impression from reading your book. On one hand, in the Mojave culture, she was able to speak her mind. I'm wondering how she was the difference when she came back into Anglo-white society as a strong woman, able to sort of have a different role in what was the difference between the way women were regarded in these particular cultures, and how did Olive try to sort of find that balance when she finally went back to the white culture?
Yeah, it was. And the Mojave in particular, the women were quite outspoken. And I think one of the explorers who came through who had encountered many tribes said, I've never seen a tribe in which the women are more outspoken than this one. So there was that. And then there was the adventuring. And then there was just the sheer matter of her journeys. You know, when she went back from the Mojave to Fort Yuma, where she was returned to after her ransom, that was a whole river journey and land journey on foot with a Mojave Indian who accompanied her. And so it was, yeah. She was a very good swimmer by the time she returned. She gave swimming lessons in Oregon to women there. So I think there was, it was quite a disparity. She seemed to suffer a lot, and whether that's about her more limited freedoms or about the tragedies she experienced. Mm. I mean, she lost two families, her biological family, and then she was ripped away from the Mojaves. And so I think that she did really suffer. When she was in Oregon, there was someone who lived in her house with her said that she could hear her walking the floor and crying at night. And so she did seem to really experience a sense of loss. And I go so far as to say PTSD.
Yeah.
Returning to society. It was difficult.
We'll put there are a number of photographs of Olive Oatman. And looking at them, you get a sense. I mean, in the Victorian days, no one smiled, so it's hard to get a sense of what they were really like by just a photograph. But she does have a kind of intensity. And there is something mysterious, mm-hmm. I have to say, when you look at her photographs.
Yeah, she does have a mysteriousness. And she was apparently fairly serious. I mean, you're right. This may not be definitive, but in all my research, I only encountered one story where she is reported to have laughed. And that was actually just after her ransom, when she was reporting to the commander who received her, who was interviewing her to find out what had happened. It was a little bit of a stumbling interview because her English was not good at that point. But he asked her a question about why what kind of food she was collecting, or why she was collecting food, and she laughed. I forget why she thought that was funny, but it occurred to me that never after that did anyone's stories about her involve laughter. She didn't seem to be serious.
Yeah, there's a promotional photo taken in 1858 of her, that's an extraordinary picture, and she's in this Victorian gown, and there are these marks on the dress that you've talked about kind of mimicking the tattoo pattern on her chin. What was that about?
Yeah, it's hard to say because that's not documented, but the hash marks on the dress seem clearly to reference the hash mark style tattoos that she wore.
Yeah.
But there's not any documentation of where this dress came from or whether that was deliberate or what.
In other photos from this session, you point out in the book that she covered up the tattoos. She was able to conceal them at times by powder and makeup.
Having said that about how she had PTSD and she was unsmiling, she did have happiness in her life. She met a man who was a cattle rancher and married him. She had met him. He came with his sister or sisters, I think, to a lecture she gave, incidentally, after this book was written by the Reverend Stratton, this somewhat scurrilous book that twisted her story and sort of delivered it in the service of his Methodist impulses. She went on a lecture tour, and initially Stratton would be the one to give the lectures about her, but people were much more interested in her, and they also just physically wanted to look at her. So she took over and delivered lectures that were apparently very compelling. People loved them. And so she on one of these tours, she met the husband, and those are sort of lovely letters where she writes her aunt telling her how she's met this man and how he's the one for her. And I love that she says, "I think he deserves me," in one of these letters.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. She has a bit of an attitude. I mean, a good one in the sense that she has a sense of self-worth, and it makes me wonder, she must have gotten that from or at least that's my sense of it anyway, that she really had a true, strong sense of self-worth from her time with the Mojaves.
Yeah, I mean, either from her survivalist experiences or from the Mojaves themselves, it's hard to say, but she did seem to have a strength. And then, you know, she lived happily with her husband. And then there's another kind of lovely layer to this, as for a character who's been ripped from her families so many times and adopted into families after being ripped from families, that she worked for an orphanage and ended up adopting a child from that orphanage. So she became an adopted mother after having been an adopted daughter in her tribe. So there was some happiness at the end of her life. I think she genuinely really loved her husband. There's this one key letter that's published in the paperback edition, sort of as an appendix or an adjunct to the story, where she
talks
about
you want to tell that story about finding it? That came from the Mormon church, didn't it?
Yeah. You know, I'm completely forgetting how I discovered that letter. But a lot of my research was there. The Mormons were great for this documentation.
Yeah.
The Mormon resources were, you know, helpful. I just forget where it came from.
Yeah. Margot Mifflin is with us. Her book is The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Margot Mifflin. We're talking about her book, The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman. Well, I wanted to ask a little bit more about this Royal Stratton character you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. He tries to really manipulate Olive Oatman's story, and there's a racist element to it. And I'm trying mm-hmm. to figure out how Olive Oatman signed on to that at all.
Yeah, I think she had to make a choice. I think the problem was that if you had been, you know, captured by Indians, it was very taboo to suggest that there was anything good about the experience, just based on the sort of political climate of the period and the attitude towards Indians. And so she pretty much had to go along with what Stratton said to survive. There were other examples of there was one woman, I forget her name, who was captured by Indians and lived with them for a while and befriended a man, not romantically, but someone who helped her during her captivity, and then later said that she loved him. And she was reviled for saying this, and he was hanged. Mm. So that sort of illustrates the consequences of expressing affection for Native Americans at that point in history. So I think she realized that she had to go along with this, and also the book was her only real meal ticket. She was not educated. She had no family. She had no husband when she, you know, first was released or ransomed back. Mm-hmm. And so Stratton took her and her brother under his wing. He did help get them educated. He sent her to college and put her on the lecture tour. But again, you know, the story was in the service of his own prejudices against Indians. So she went along with that. But what I discovered was just that there was so much, it was so hard to cross-reference what he claimed with what she had said to the press before he got his hands on her. And especially this first interview at Fort Yuma with the commander there, where she talked lovingly about the Mojave and talked, you know, said many of the things I just said about how they helped her. And so, you know, it was dramatized for me there.
It's so interesting also the way the different elements of this story have been manipulated over the years. And it's interesting to see how they're reflected in stories and books and like The Searchers. Like, I mean, if you bring it up to, you know, John Ford's film with John Wayne, The Searchers, these captive rescue plot lines, how are they changing? I mean, that particular one is an interesting story, the Searchers. I mean, it's about a white woman who's kidnapped and similar to Olive's story, or at least what we think, she doesn't mm-hmm. want to go back. I mean, would you talk a little bit about that? That's really interesting.
Yeah, there are resonances there. And in that period, too, there's a sort of there's an interesting parallel that happens. I mean, Oatman's story has been reclaimed and retold and fictionalized in so many ways. There were stage plays about it. There are radio shows about it. Novels have been written about it. Children's books. Elmore Leonard wrote a story mm-hmm. about it. And there's a lot of interpretation, a lot of which reflects whatever period the reinterpretation is happening in. So at some point, these Indian captivity stories and Indian adventure attack stories in the 50s and 60s start to reflect anxieties about civil rights. The Indians are no longer a threat to white Americans at that point. So the captivity stories are still being told, but they're sort of hitting on other issues that are happening more contemporaneously at that time. Now it's interesting. The show Hell on Wheels has a character based on Olive Oatman, and that one is also – it's not intended to be factual, but it's somewhat unfortunately also twisted because they've cast her as a prostitute, this character Eva, who has a chin tattoo identical to Olive Oatman's.
Yeah.
And was clearly inspired by her. It's unfortunate to me just because – first of all, historically, women in tattoos, the implication is so often that tattooed women are somehow loose or sexualized. So to make the character a prostitute and conflate the tattoo with her prostitution seems unfortunate. And the character is presented as having been tattooed as a slave before she enters this mining camp or railroad camp where she enters the drama. So But the interpretations go right up to the present, and that show seems to have revived interest in Olive Oatman. I see a lot of people writing about it and asking who she really was.
Yeah. Elmore Leonard's take on the story, you write a bit about the Tonto woman.
Mm-hmm, yes. So he wrote a story based on what he had read of it, part of which was the Stratton.
Yeah.
The Stratton account, the Reverend, and he wrote a very interesting story from the perspective of the captive, who was loosely Olive Oatman, which was nice in the sense that you sort of see her agency and her suffering in it. The premise is that she's being held by her Texas husband, who sort of makes her live out in the back of his house because of her tattoo, and Elmore Leonard, who read my book and blurbed my book, told me that if he had known what I discovered in writing this book, that he would have written that story very differently, that there was so much more, so much more richness and so many layers to her story that he would have liked to take a crack at it differently.
Explain what became of the Brewsterites. I mean, that seems like a strange little strand, but that's such an interesting part of the story. I mean, they think they're headed to this promised land. Once they get there, they realize, man, this is not a promised land.
Yeah, they did splinter off. And, you know, I'm forgetting exactly where James Collin in particular ended, but he did not meet a happy end, as I recall. But the details have escaped me at the moment. It is in the book, though, where they all landed.
Right. And here's how you put it in the book. You say, one look at the landscape where they settled told them that the boy prophet James Collin Brewster's visionary powers were as bankrupt as his revelations were changeable. I mean, it was a wasteland where they ended up. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary to think of undertaking this whole mission and not knowing first what the journey was going to be like. A lot of material was published back then about these trips by people who hadn't taken them. They just fabricated this stuff or heard it from other people. And, you know, the length of time traveled was not accurate, the condition of the roads, the Indian threats, and so forth. And not to mention that they just couldn't imagine what they were going to find at the other end. And because it hadn't been well documented, they really couldn't know.
Yeah. It's been 6 years or so since you first published the book. And then you wrote about the sort of the myth of the Western frontier and America's preoccupation with brown-skinned terrorists. Seems still pretty relevant. Our own ethnic boundaries, you say in the book, are blurred beyond recognition. And so in that sense, this story is still really, really appropriate.
Yeah, both in the sense of the brown skin terrorists and the fear of brown people, and more so now with, you know, immigrant populations and the quote other intruding on white land and taking white jobs and so forth. It does seem to be significant, but primarily in terms of the biculturalism of our country, that we're so multi-ethnic and we're and increasingly so. To look at this woman who was there, you know, closer, not exactly at the founding of our country, but at the exploration of the West, the migration West, to see what sort of the culture clashes that were going on around her, and to have this sort of visible evidence of that on her face was sort of a poetic image.
A white woman of color, you say, a foreigner in her own country, a beautiful freak whose blue tattoo denotes the shaky fault lines between civilization and savagery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Standing between two cultures and perpetually, I mean, she's encountering these multiple cultures in her journey. But then when she returns to white culture, she can never really resolve the two parts of her being, the white and the Mojave.
Let me ask you finally, how do you describe your relationship with Olive Oatman? It's been a while since you've written this book, but you must have gotten really close to her, at least.
Yeah, I think about her a lot, especially because the interest in her seems to be ongoing. But so I feel for her, and often I feel sad for her, even though her life ended in some ways happily. But I also wonder what she would think of the retellings of her stories. I tried to retell her story in the most accurate way I could, but there's a lot of missing information. So sometimes I wonder what she would tell me if she could tell me more. Hmm.
Margo Mifflin. Her book is The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman. Mifflin is an English professor at the City University of New York. She joined us from a studio near her home in Nyack, New York. And Professor, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Josh Weathers, a producer for Video West. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Vickers. Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.